I had heard stories too about his, some of his postdocs who were talking about students being free to do whatever. And I guess the same thing was true with some of the postdocs. There was, would have been in the 60s, I guess. Was it the Chlorophyll Project when there was a revolt of the postdocs?
I only heard about it secondhand, I think it was in the Chlorophyll one. Bonnet in England, by the way, has finally published that paper. I'm not sure whether you saw it. It came out of the special of tetrahedral.
Yes, I didn't see it, but I heard somebody told me that it was out.
Yeah. That's a labor of love.
But checking, you came here in 67. What, compare Harvard with Yale if it's possible in terms of.
One of the really strong points that Yale was a concern for undergraduate teaching. It was simply in the atmosphere that no matter who you were, it was an important part of your life to teach undergraduates. And as a result, the undergraduates had a much better time of it. They worked harder, with more enthusiasm, accomplished more. And therefore were more fun to teach. Here, there was no tradition of that sort by the time I arrived. God knows what it might have been before, when everybody taught undergraduates. Presumably it was in the air then, but by that time, Woodward had been here for how many years and never taught an undergraduate in his life? Corey had been here for how many years and never taught an undergraduate? So there was now a division in the department between those who were carrying the undergraduate teaching burden. And it was now a burden. I automatically used that word without thinking about it. And those who were above it and whose research was so important, their contribution to science, the teaching of postdocs, all the rest was their way of doing it. At Yale, I think the only professor who didn't teach undergraduate was Zansager, and that's because nobody would have been able to understand his English. I mean, even the graduate students referred to his courses Norwegian 1 and 2. That was a real shock to me, to come to a place where something that I enjoyed doing, from which I got tremendous satisfaction, was no longer valued. And Bob disapproved of my teaching undergraduates.
That's amazing.
So, ever after, I said, gee, if you have a choice of sending your kid to Yale or Harvard, as far as chemistry is concerned, I certainly would send them to Yale without any doubt. And I think that's still true.
The junior professors are the ones that do the teaching at the lower level?
Yeah. Well, and so David Evans, I shouldn't be saying all these things, but David Evans is very good about it. He comes from a tradition where teaching undergraduates is an important thing. I don't think Stuart Shriver is ever going to teach an undergraduate. George Whitesides has taught undergraduate course, but only with essentially the full-time assistance of another junior professor who may have given half or three-quarters of the lecture. And then that, not one of the big courses, but let's say science for non-scientists, and emphasis on applications and relation of chemistry to living processes and things like that. Pichy tried, and I tried very hard to get him into it, and you know, arranged that he should teach a higher level undergraduate course, but it really was too strenuous for him and for them. And so that wasn't really a matter of unwillingness, you know, he values it. And I guess Jeremy taught undergraduate once or twice. Of course, did a superb job of it. It's now at a point where at least every year there's a visiting professor here to help teach the undergraduate. And that really wouldn't happen at Yale, even to them.
I can remember years ago, Farrington Daniels always taught freshman chemistry.
Yeah.
And felt that it was very important to have the best people at that point. Is that more or less unique to Harvard, or is that common? I'm not familiar, let's say, Berkeley or...
I don't know. I think it's unique to Harvard. Or let's say this must be the prime example of it.
What else about the Harvard period? Is there any... It's been now... How many years?
Well, I was sort of active for 20 years before retiring. And the other thing that strikes me more generally, I don't know whether it has to do with Harvard, although I think it does, the quality of graduate student, at least that I have been able to attract, was certainly highest at Columbia. Now then, we said those were very special years. Mm-hmm. And many of those kids came out of the Bronx High School of Science, the Brooklyn, what was it, and were really very, very specially gifted and certainly enthusiastic. And Columbia was a small college with 2,000 students, 2,400 students in the university, with a total enrollment of 20 or so in those days. And there again, the professors, you know, so cherished their little college. There was no question about your enjoying teaching undergraduates and being convinced that it was very important to do. And the feedback loop was so strong, because these students were so enthusiastic. And Yale was sort of in the middle. And by the time I got here, it was I changed. But it was also for some reason, I had my best graduate students at Columbia, and then some very, very good ones at Yale, and really sort of a mediocre lot. Here. And that can be explained, one, by my getting older, two, by the extraordinary magnetism of the synthetic activity at Harvard, so that there's a self-selection process going on, that they're not looking to Harvard for mechanistic organic chemistry, or whatever you want to call it. And But so from that point of view, it was a bad move for me. But it, you know, I repeat, that certainly could be my fault. The work is no longer. It's also the period in which the National Science Foundation isn't supporting physical organic chemistry very well, right? Just that period. So there's probably no single. But I would have been much better off in Karlsruhe.
There are still some areas, going back to some early work that we hadn't talked about. One of those is the Bovelline period. I was always intrigued by, go back to the story you told me of how you found Huckel's book, Bicycling Through Europe.
Yes.
And 20 years later or so, whatever it was, here you are being one of the first to use it in a very extraordinary way.
On the Trochilia of iron and
yes.
So on. Yeah. But not without the help of George Kimball and other people who explained it all to me and so forth. But the Bovelline thing is just a direct outcome of those early days with Cope and with worrying about the Cope rearrangement, getting into this whole business of no mechanism reactions. And the big contribution, of course, in that whole area is the Woodward-Hoffman rules. I don't think there's any question about that. But I've made some contribution to the ones that don't obey the rules. Well, you see, one of the most interesting things about the no mechanism concept, it forced one to ask, what questions are left to answer? And the only question left to answer is, why is the activation energy what it is? And if there are stereochemical choices, why is the activation energy for one of them higher and for the other one lower, which in concerted processes has its complete answer in the Woodward-Hoffman rules. But it forces you to think about enthalpy and entropy as the bedrock factors in chemical reactions, and the ultimate purpose of chemistry is to translate structure into those parameters. Why doesn't butane go to hydrogen and two molecules of ethylene? Well, it's not an arrow pushing problem. It's not a Woodward-Hoffman problem. It is a bedrock problem to which no one at the moment can give an answer. But anyway, I got on the energy kick once I realized what the Cope rearrangement was all about, and with an artificially created holy grail, that is, trying now to get the Cope rearrangement to go so fast that the activation enthalpy was zero. And then what kind of a molecule would that be? So that the with a Cope rearrangement having an enthalpy of activation of 35 kilocalories, then you can put on a three-membered ring and bring it down into the 20s, and then you can do further things that gradually get you down to to homotropylidine, and then as having realized that you could make this homotropility rearrangement, then it just came in a flash that if you introduce a threefold symmetry, that it would be a very remarkable molecule. And there have only been two or three flashes like that in my life, but they really are great. And the effort, you know, has been keeps on people both at the theoretical level. Michael Dewar at the theoretical level is one, and several other persons at the experimental level, to bring that activation energy down by various devices, substitutions, and what still hasn't got to zero. I think nature doesn't like zero. But that really was quite fabulous.
Some interesting nomenclature in all of those compounds.
Well, you must know that to be worth living, life has to be somewhat amusing for me. And one innocuous way of getting a little pleasure is to find names for things. But the Bouveline name actually came from graduate students from Mae Jones and Bob Wilcott, I think. Funny how a name like that sticks, too.
Yes. Well, the alternative, if you're going to use standardized nomenclature, is hopeless.
Hopeless. So it might as well be silly.
Yes. I don't remember where it was, but somebody once presented a paper where he called the compound George. And then the dimer was by George.
That's great.
I enjoyed that very much. It was a real paper, too. Peter Leermakers, was he one of your postdocs?
Yes. Yeah.
Tell me something about him.
Well, he was on the wild side already as a postdoc. And he would come in the morning and have his few cc's of alcohol. But a very stimulating, imaginative guy, and a person I came to like very much, and for whom I had really very, very great hopes. It was sort of hard to get him to finish things in the laboratory, and I remember on one thing, getting him to complete it by betting him $100 he couldn't do it. And I thought that was cheap at twice the price. But it was really, really too bad that he died, because I think he was settling down. Had a great deal of problems. So he was in on the first of the energy flow ideas.
Are there any other postdocs of note that we should talk about?
I don't know.
We haven't discussed.
Well, there's a list of these very influential, now very influential German professors. Full professors, Prinzbach at Freiburg, and Gerhard Schroeder at Karlsruhe, Wolfgang Roth at Bochum, Kirmser, who stayed on it largely in the carbon field, but then made very important contributions in the carbon field. Gerhard Schlumpf in Holland. But the their influence on German organic chemistry has been quite significant, because there wasn't a hell of a lot of mechanistic organic chemistry going on. And so there's the Weiskin influence, and then I think there's the influence of these four people that I mentioned. And they, they're just at the top of the group in Germany now. All very enthusiastic characters, particularly Prinzbach. You don't know Prinzbach.
No,
he's not a wild guy. But amazingly successful.
How would you characterize the change in physical organic? You've watched it now for a long period of time. You said that it's hard to get funding for it now. And
yeah.
Do you think it's seen its heyday? Is it past its peak, or is it just need to regroup?
I don't think it's begun to peak, because the criterion one would use is this, that if you write down a new reaction that you haven't seen before, can you tell me how fast it's going to go under what conditions? Or if you conclude that it's not going to go very fast, can you then tell me, well, use such and such a catalyst and it will work in such and such a way and it'll give you so many kilocalories and so forth. So we're obviously very, very far away from that point, and it's illustrated further by how little one knows about quantitatively about the role of solvent in the, particularly the ionic reaction, and how slow the progress is. After all, dimethyl sulfoxide, crown ether, and a few other solvents were really just the effect on organic reactions was discovered. It wasn't invented. It did not come out of a state which sciences can arrive at, where you know so much that you can say, well, it's never been done, but I can predict it will be done and work in that direction. I think that the mechanistic problems are now are really very difficult, particularly because so many of them do involve the solvent. Another closely related, in my mind, a closely related area is the understanding of enzyme catalysis. And in my view, those are idiosyncratic solvents, if you will, in which the reactions occur and the protein is doing various things. Well, you know, mechanism in that area is progressing very, very slowly. It's not simply basic organic chemistry that's progressing slowly at the level of understanding. And I think the problems are tough. And when you combine that with very little money and an already dwindled audience, then it's going to be some time. It's now very difficult to find anyone, any junior person who can teach a course in advanced mechanistic organic chemistry, because they have not themselves been taught one, or worse, they haven't worked with a person who did. So you would, if you ask, well, the students of, with whom would one work if one wanted to be a mechanistic organic chemist? That's another way of putting it. Most of the ones that you would now mention are old or gone. And notice that I now use mechanistic organic chemistry rather than physical organic, because not a new crop or a different crop has appeared, but there are a large number of chemists who apply new and developing physical methods to organic chemical problems, be they mechanistic or structural. Are more concerned about the physical method than they are about the problem in organic chemistry. In other words, let's say a physical organic chemist who is in NMR spectroscopy and developing two-dimensional NMR is not doing it with a chemical problem in mind, but rather how can I advance the resolution power of this method. And that's very important. But it in the old days, a so-called physical organic chemist was somebody who also did kinetics, right? Because that was physical chemistry. And infrared spectroscopy was done by physical chemists. And then later you had persons like Bachnerby. Bachnerby was one of the early physical organic chemists, a sort of which we have many floating around today, who became wedded to one particular physical method and made big contributions in it, no question. But is not a person who said, well, here is a problem in the transformation of one chemical into another, one structure of matter into another, but to which I want, in which I want to gain further insight, or to which I want to give further understanding, and then use whatever method might be needed. And I think that's the big difference, that the mechanistic organic chemist has a question, or if you want to put it, a problem, and now is trying to figure ways of probing it. And if it requires high pressure, I'm not setting up any high pressure equipment. I'm going to Klerner in Bochum and let him do it, or ask him, would he collaborate? But whatever needs to be done, and if it's radioactive isotopes, well, there'd be someone around who's willing to do it. So, and it's the mechanistic organic chemist who has disappeared. And so you're quite right when in asking the question, do you think it's slowed down? Well, yes. Do I think it's come to an end? No. I think the people aren't there. You see persons like Durbin or Bergman who start out that way and very quickly move somewhere else. Maybe it's because problems are too tough. Maybe it's because there's no money in it. Maybe it's because the audience is very small.